Hello and welcome back to the Research VR podcast. I'm your host, Oz Balabanian, and I'm here with Peter Lekoff, my co-host.
Hello, everyone.
And our two special guests today are experts from the field of 3D audio, or just audio in general. Sally Calloway, an industry-leading voice for audio in VR, AR, and MR. Hi, Sally.
Hi, everyone.
And with us, we also have Kaushik Sundar, an audio perceptual researcher who also is an expert. Hello, Kaushik.
Hey. Hey, everyone.
Well, today's podcast is going to be a fun one. I don't think we talk about 3D audio all that much on the podcast. We try to bring it up as much as we can, but I don't know. I don't consider myself knowledgeable enough to like speak as an authority. So that's why we bring experts like you on the show. But before we jump into the field of audio, let's talk a little bit about the news. I want to give an update on the Varjo headset, which we mentioned before. They've raised a $6.7 million investment to build their first batch of human eye resolution headsets, which basically, I mean, they don't have like an 8K number associated with the headset because they don't build their headsets in that fashion. I think their headsets are a combination of a huge 1920 by 1080 display headset, which is a normal, you know, Rift or Vive. But as on top of that, they have a smaller, way smaller version. That second display that they have in the headset is actually another 1920 by 1080 display, but it's way smaller and it has a higher pixel per inch density. And they use that to cover the fovea of your vision. And so what you're looking at is an extremely dense display, and the peripheral vision is covered by that the second 1920 by 1080 display. We think it's a really interesting design, and unless any one of us have actually tried it, I don't think we can say how it looks. However, I think Darshan Shankar, the CEO of Big Screen, actually tweeted a week or two ago that he had just tried it and he was blown away by the resolution that he had seen. So we're really excited.
Now, the question is if they really can quick enough adjust the mirrors that are projecting the high resolution screen on the low resolution screen. And if it's going to work out like, you know, 120 frames per second and with a delay from eye tracking, then adjusting the mirrors. But in theory, it's a very neat concept because it solves basically the problem of having a very, very dense screen by, you know, just projecting the foveated area where you're looking at.
Right.
So if they succeed, it's awesome.
It's super similar to how foveated rendering works by, you know, covering different resolutions in different parts of your vision.
Yes.
Sally and Kaushik, are you interested in higher resolution headsets or do you just care about headphones?
Well, I think it's silly to say that you like and work in VR or AR, MR, any of the Rs and don't have an interest in the visual hardware that goes along with the audio as well. Because at the end of the day, they have to work together to actually be a really convincing product and experience.
To make it more, at the end of the day, we are looking to make this everything more and more immersive. And audio and visual, they go hand in hand together. So there's no way you can have any kind of any lower resolution on one aspect.
That's right. And to build off of that, actually, today, Google... Just this morning, actually, I just read this. Google released some new research that goes into foveated rendering techniques, some of the newer techniques that they've been working on, things called phase-aligned foveated rendering and conformal foveated rendering. And so there's a great write-up, actually, on Road to VR that we'll be linking to and talking about what each method is being used for, some that are better for mobile VR, some that are better at, like, basically reducing the amount of data that's being sent to the headset. There's a lot of research that's being done into figuring out how our eyes work and how to maximize, you know, the potential of your retinas. And do you guys see similarly the audio field really booming in this new generation and people really trying to understand how your ears work and how to create sounds that mimic things that you hear around the world?
Yeah, in the audio field, I mean, trying to understand how human ears work and, you know, in 3D audio, we've been doing it for a long, long time, like more than 5 to 6 decades now. but then the challenges are so much, so much more. And so it's so much more challenging when it comes to 3D audio, especially the fact that every human ear is as unique as a fingerprint. So we've been trying to still solve problems related to how to, individualize audio to your ears. You know, that's been the biggest challenge. I think Sally will definitely have more to add on that.
I was just going to say exactly the same as you, really, Kaushik, that like this isn't a new field of research. It's just new now that we can actually apply it to like the tools and technologies that content creators are using and actually put it in front of many, 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 many more consumers.
It's making the research, relevant now. As before, you know, there weren't many ways to create products that are accessible to people, or there wasn't a way of like fitting a product into a market where it made sense. I think now we're starting to see, you know, it becoming relevant. Would you say that's like a fair assessment?
Yes and no. I would say yes, because like the point that I made just before, that now we have devices that everyone can use, mobile phones that can actually do all this processing and deliver a really immersive experience, virtual augmented reality, whichever one you choose to focus on. But no, at the same time, purely because there's been like a few products around for years or even decades that sort of have been using these technologies at a foundational level, but it didn't really make sense to market it as a virtual reality thing, because that wasn't really a thing that people were doing like maybe a couple of years ago or 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah. As I know, I was working as a visiting researcher at the Human Factors Department at NASA, and there, even in the early 90s, in fact, the researcher I was working with, Dr. Duran Begold, he had released a book in the early 90s that was for 3D audio for virtual reality. It was like back, I think it was like 92 or 94. And, you know, the ideas were there, you know, the technology was there, the research problems were there, there were solutions for it. But at that time, there was, as Sally mentioned, you know, there was no interest in the market. Now, smartphones and VR headsets, it's just becoming more and more relevant, and these problems are again surfacing.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like the 90s was also kind of the time when the Sound Blaster 3D audio kind of like sound cards were a thing. So games had 3D audio back in the 90s, but when those companies were bought up by other larger companies, then they kind of ended up dissipating. The technology went away because that external sound card wasn't there to do that processing. So we're seeing like a renaissance of this technology all over again. And for us, like for Kaushik and I, it's just exciting that we get to apply all of our knowledge to new parts of the industry and new industries as well.
It's fascinating, and we'll get back into this topic. I know it's very easy for us to talk about audio. We have a couple of things I want to get through. The Vive Focus headset has the specifications for the headset have been announced. The display resolution, the refresh rates. Let's talk about it for a moment. So the display is a 2880 by 1600 3K AMOLED display. I don't know who the manufacturer is. I don't know if they've put that out yet. And it's running at a 75 hertz refresh rate with 110 degrees of field of view. It is running the Qualcomm Snapdragon 835 processor, which I believe this is the same. This is an iteration of the Qualcomm reference design that they put out last year that was also based on the 835 processor. Yes. I did not expect for Vive to be making that, but I guess they did.
Well, to be honest, it's really strange, and I hope it will cover this news too. Snapdragon just announced a new processor, the 845, that is theoretically way more suited for VR, so that they release basically a headset on a processor that has been since 1.5-2 years on each flagship phone. Seems strange, but hey, why not?
Yeah, I don't know in terms of the life cycles of processors, but by the fact that Qualcomm has announced a new chip, you know, that's probably inaccessible to a lot of OEMs at this point, right? Is that something that they'll be releasing?
Well, Yes, but I would say that you don't expect, 20 million of the Vive Focus devices to be sold immediately. It will be, if they sell 1 million, it's fine. And as Qualcomm basically made a huge stance on the fact that the new processor can do way better VR, it would be maybe also a nice lighthouse project for them, especially when you think that they implemented the reference design of the A35. They seem to work close together anyway, right?
That's right. The one thing I want to point out actually is not only display is like pretty high res compared to what we're used to nowadays, but the refresh rate is at a interesting point. I've either seen 60 or 90. I don't think I've seen 75 hertz in a headset yet. Is that does that change anything, or does that change anything that the developers have to design around?
Well, if you see how most applications behave on the PC, you usually have anyway them running in 45 and then using Time Warp or the other technology for basically a super sample at high end. If you have less frames, you definitely need less calculation power, but if you, let's say, would have, the half of 90 is 45 hertz. Mm-hmm. It would look strange. If you have 90, you can, do the half and it's fine because this panel can handle. But this odd number of 75 seems to be strange because what is the half of 75? It would have not an even number. Yeah. And I don't expect many applications running in 75 anyway. So it's strange.
Yeah, it is definitely strange. And another strange fact is, at least that I'm reading, the sensors, there's 9 axis like degrees of freedom. So what are the 3 other degrees of freedom that I'm not understanding? Or maybe the way that the reason why they wrote 9 axis sensor is like 6 DOF headset and a 3 DOF controller?
I think that's what they mean.
Is that what that means? Okay. Because I don't know why they would put that. Can you just add those dimensions and call it 9?
Yes. Well, in theory, you can. If you, for example, think about robot arms, they usually have like 9 or 12 or whatever high number of degrees of freedom. But you kind of think, okay, it's three-dimensional space is only 3. The thing is, they have joints. And each joint kind of has its own. They kind of add together so the arm can do this very complex movements. So it seems as they just, summed up the number and said, okay, we are better than everyone else. We have now 9 degrees of freedom because space is three-dimensional. Well, fine. It's marketing.
Yeah, it's pretty great. I think that's all the news that I wanted to get through. And Peter, you just talked about the Qualcomm 845 processor. If there's anything you want to add on top of that.
It's quite impressive to see that the processors that will be basically in the next flagship phones and most likely also the most VR headsets that will come at some point. It's going to have the Snapdragon processor that is just 30% faster than the previous one. So they didn't increase or decrease the nanometer size. They just had this TikTok. So I think it's TikTok that they used. So they just improved slightly the capability. What's, however, interesting is that they have built a SLAM, so simultaneous location and mapping unit on top of it. Mm. Yet they don't have any dedicated neural network stuff, which might be interesting for using augmented reality, for example. So I honestly, even though I'm not as big fan of Apple regards augmented reality and virtual reality because I just do too little in my mind, they could push it way more. The processor they have on the iPhone, for example, is way faster in theory. So I just don't know if this 845 will be fast enough to deliver really awesome augmented reality, virtual reality experiences from the calculation of performance. They have a new unit that does 2K by 2K at 120 hertz. So it's really a lot, and it's really impressive. But the chip itself feels more like Qualcomm is doing them, obviously, for everyone. It's a generic chip, so it's suited for everything, and you see the trade-off from the perspective of VR being done here. So it's not suited just for VR, but VR is one of the points they try to optimize, and they have more GPU performance, more CPU performance, but I don't know if this is going to be the groundbreaking platform yet.
In terms of comparing that to Apple, I think, Sally, you were telling me before we started recording that you were looking into, all the processing power that's now available on mobile. How does that fit in? How does that fit into, into how you consider using these devices and comparing to like the processing power that we just had access to for the past couple of years on computers?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting space to keep tabs on as someone who just does audio. Like, why would an audio person care about computing power? But anyone that works in game audio knows that you have a fraction of whatever the processing power of the device that you're publishing to use for your calculations. So when you're considering how complex augmented reality audio can be in the future, which is what the article that I'm writing about is, I looked into the specs of like the iPhone 10, the Pixel 2 XL, the Samsung Galaxy S8 Plus, and compared that to like what the minimum spec of a Vive that's recommended, a Vive ready PC that's recommended by HTC. And I was embarrassed to find out that like my MacBook Pro, which is a couple of years old, is like technically like a little bit slower than some of these phones, although it has more RAM. So that's a really interesting kind of implication there, that testing across different devices and what kind of like percentages we'll get for audio processing in the future might potentially change, or we'll just get more freedom as sound designers to chew up some more resources to use for cool audio simulations. Like there's a lot of potential that I can see in the future. Just hopefully it trickles down to us poor audio people.
I actually have a follow-up question. So I was a few weeks ago on the VRST in Sweden. It was a VR conference, and I met there Alex Baldwin, who had a poster about a mobile augmented reality application that uses scattering delay networks for room acoustic synthesis. And what I found quite fascinating is that there are people working on audio and augmented reality, and I was kind of not aware of this topic till then. And it seems like you also go in that direction. So what are the challenges regards augmented reality and audio compared to VR? Because as far as I understand, even in virtual reality, to calculate the proper bouncing of sound from materials, from walls, and having a proper stereo sound is not as trivial. But I assume if you have even less knowledge about the world, because it's a real world and the device doesn't know the surface probes, how do you even approach it? Is it even calculation why it's doable on a mobile device at all?
So one of the biggest challenges at this point when you talk about augmented reality or mixed reality and for, you know, 3D audio kind of applications, like say you have an MR headset or, you know, where you want to, where there is a musician in the VR domain, and then there is like a real musician in outside in the local space you're in. And if you talk about them jamming with each other, and you have to make sure that the environment in the VR space, the acoustics rendered in the VR space is the same as the acoustics of the local space. So then the challenges come in how you capture the acoustics of the local space as fast as possible, you know, having microphones outside the headset. You know, try to match the acoustics of the local space with the VR space and try to reduce this, like the sense of disbelief as a listener. So now that's extremely challenging to you know, how do you predict the acoustics of where you are in, you know. So I mean, there have been a lot of research off late. There's few papers from John Mark Jart, who has been working on, you know, blind estimation of these reverberation fingerprints. I think that's a very, very important aspect, you know, to make AR, MR like very seamless.
Mm-hmm. Speaking from the cognitive abilities of the human, so as far as I understand, the human ear is capable of differentiating very minor changes in how something sounds. That's why when you have, for example, the special microphones that are shaped like an ear, and you have basically a real nose formed on this microphone thingy, you record way more natural sound. Now, when you compare the two eyes, well, let's say virtual reality right now, visually, doesn't look really realistic. So it's kind of an abstraction. So our brain is capable of accepting more rough estimation of the real world. But in terms of sound, would you say it's correct that it needs to be really, either really good or it doesn't work at all?
I think, Sally, go ahead.
Absolutely. Like, I'm not totally in with all of the perceptual research. Perhaps Kaushik knows a little bit more about the background to, like, what the threshold is that you need to meet for it to feel really or to sound really real. But people can tell when the audio is off, and it off as in not totally accurate. And when you do that to people, because sound is such a, like, subconscious sense that we have, it can really kind of push people towards, like, not being as immersed or present within your experience very, very quickly. So avoiding that sort of situation by using, like, appropriate technologies and then getting someone who really knows what they're doing to mix the sound for your 360 or VR experience is actually really important, and keeping across all the different, like, news and technology in this area so that you do know what the standard is and what actually sounds, what could sound good or sound the best for your experience is really important.
I agree with Sally, and I also think it goes both ways. I mean, similar to any other sense, right? Sound has this ability that, human brains have this ability to, if there are some missing information in the sound, to, you know, fill it in and able to understand what's missing in there. Like, it's very easy to add some bias and improve your perception. Like, for example, in 3D audio, often when we talk about having very individualized audio, we have to make sure it's like perfect, like the frontal what we call the HRTF cues, they have to be really, really perfect. But then there are ways to fool your brain, if you have like a visual, if you bring in a visual cue there, your brain kind of visual cues have always been more prominent that way. So it kind of fools your brain and in accepting that the source is in the front or in the back. And also there's a lot of research in this field called psychoacoustic bass enhancement. So how to get really good bass from really small speakers. So in those kind of applications, you don't really have the ability to have a very low fundamental frequency, for the bass. So what they do is they add in harmonics at higher frequencies, and that, perceptually that has an effect of missing bass. So again, your brain can fill up things that actually doesn't exist over there. So I think it proves where there is perception, there is illusion.
That's so true.
That's the quote of the day.
Psychoacoustic tricks are used all across game audio and film audio as well. So you're being tricked without even knowing it.
Before we keep moving, actually, I should have done this earlier. Let's talk a little bit about your backgrounds and how you found yourself in this position.
Interesting. Okay, I can go first.
Yeah.
So my background is in, first of all, sound engineering and sound design. So I've been working first and foremost in actually video games doing game audio there. I even worked at like a mocap studio too doing motion capture. That was really fun. But I really quickly kind of jumped across into doing more acoustics and psychoacoustics research. So I've done a master's in audio and acoustics, and I wrote a couple of papers on psychoacoustics and particularly how the voice is perceived in virtual auditory displays. And I wanted to apply that straight across into industry as well. And when I finished my master's, it just so happened to be the time when VR was kind of like trying to pick up again. So I ended up working for a software engineering company that makes audio middleware for games, and then jumped across to a VR company. And now I'm here in the States, and I've just finished working for OSIC on their 3D audio headphones, doing both content creation, business development, and also helping out the extremely cool and smart research guys that we had on the team, like Kaushik.
So so I have been a musician all my life, practice Indian classical music, and I mean, I think like for most of us in audio, that's been our main motivation. We are interested in music either as a musician or just a passionate listener. I went on to do my electrical engineering, and And during that time, I had an opportunity to go to Germany. I was working at TU Dresden. I was working on some psychoacoustic stuff. So that was kind of my first introduction to psychoacoustics and perceptual research. And I did my PhD in psychoacoustics and 3D audio in Singapore, in NTU Singapore. I was working at the signal processing lab. So, I mean, as you can see, I come from a more academic research background. So after my PhD, I was working as a visiting research scientist at NASA for a while in human factors department. Then I went on to do my postdoc at McGill University in the sound recording department. And now I'm doing research in San Diego. I've seen a lot of interest in psychoacoustics of late and 3D audio, like a renaissance of 3D audio again. You know, it's coming back again with VR, and it's just very, very exciting to be in this field at this point of time. And all the more, you know, the importance of understanding psychoacoustics in developing all these products, it just makes it easier. And as I said, there are many ways to trick your brain, and it's if you know those tricks, it just helps.
Awesome. I think all of this knowledge that you guys have accumulated will really help kind of break down some of the principles that I think people should know. I think a lot of our main audience actually are both VR developers, AR developers, as well as just like really hardcore enthusiasts that are fascinated by, you know, how these emerging technologies do work as convinced. Well, I don't know if they're convincing, but they work pretty damn well for the low fidelity that they still are. Let's talk a little bit about capture. So the sound captured, you know, there's many different microphones, many different ways of capturing sound, many different ways of then reprojecting that back to your ears. But the one field that I've been really interested in has been ambisonics, and related to that are binaural microphones. I'm sure you guys have a pretty good understanding of like what products are out there. And can we talk a little bit about the state of these microphones, and if have they, you know, and how do they fit into your workflow?
Absolutely. So like ambisonics is only, and especially ambisonics microphones, they're only one part of the equation for spatial audio or 3D audio. So microphones are obviously like hardware products. And as you said before, like you're interested in how they're used for capture, but ambisonics as a technology, we also use that to mix audio or place audio sounds, sound sources in a field, and then also use that as a format to transport like 360 audio to different formats too. So people that work in doing sound design for VR, if they're working on a 360 film, they'll be using ambisonics technology, whether that's just on the software, like in a computer to do their mixing and then transportation of the mix. But they might also have like an ambisonics microphone, like you said. So like these spatialization plugins that we use, they can place things in ambisonics like 360 space. And you can use those for in like a digital audio workstation or a piece of software like Adobe Premiere, right through to like game audio kind of tools or Unity even, FMOD wise, those types of tools. So when it comes to the state of the art right now with ambisonics, like ambisonics has been around for such a long time, and we've not only just the research industry, but now we have like this consumer and creators industries that are kind of latching onto it. We're seeing a little bit more development in the field. So we've had like Sennheiser join in with the Ambio VR mic, which is a first order ambisonics mic. And then we've also had very recently, so Soundfield released a second order ambisonics mic. So that uses more channels of capture to capture a higher resolution of audio in that space.
What's the difference between first order, second order? How does it rate?
Yeah, so rate as in perceptually, or what are the mechanical differences? Because like when it comes to ambisonics,
it's the resolution, a spatial resolution.
Yeah. Is it? Would you compare it to having more cameras in a 360 rig?
Yeah, it's basically it works all on the principle of dividing the sound field in spherical harmonics. So if you just think about this as independent basis functions, like, so like the first order, it's mainly like a mono source, omnidirectional source. Then as you add as you add in more and more spherical harmonics, it becomes more and more directional.
So can I understand it as basically the idea that when you have an orchestra playing and you have enough microphones, you can, through independent component analysis, differentiate different instruments? Yeah. And the same you basically apply here?
Yeah.
Like the decomposition into different sources, or what are you actually decompositioning into?
So it's mainly spatio-temporal decomposition, right? So you're sampling not only in time now, but you're sampling now in space. So that's why, like, the higher the order of ambisonics, higher the order of these microphones, better is your way to, you know, you have so much higher resolution in space that you can do more things.
And just so I can understand, what does resolution mean in an audio sense? Does that mean you can, when you close your eyes and you're listening to a recording from an ambisonic microphone, that's, let's say, like second order, you can close your eyes and point in a more clear direction from where the sound is coming from?
Yeah, I mean, that's it's capturing. Can you capture that particular direction well, right? So if you see this, Visisonics has this product of sound camera, it's called, right? Yeah. And basically, they have like 64 microphones. And it's they say it can record like very high order, ambisonics content, you know, can like seventh or eighth order. But the idea is now they have so many microphones. They also use it for, as the name suggests, it's a sound camera. You can use beamforming techniques to capture the sound just from a particular direction, and it just gives in more and more resolution.
I've been on the sync CeBIT this year, and I saw there like a huge array, was 64, maybe 128 microphones. They had them like on a plane and also on a sphere, and their claim was that they can, for example, detect certain noises from kilometers away from factories and figure out what's broken. So this is what it's basically used for, right?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, there are many applications for it. Like, if you have many microphones, it just, of course, recording, but then you can do beamforming and do all sorts of applications that you just mentioned.
Okay.
Well,
fascinating.
Sounds like, I mean, that's on the high end of where you can apply a lot of this research. As something that's accessible for content creators today, I mean, what are the basics that they should be aware of, or things that they should at least start to look into to create a better audio, experience in their VR experiences?
They kind of need to. It depends a lot on what their budget is, because as cost effective and cost efficient as these tools are now, we're going to be talking just about ambisonics microphones. They still cost quite a bit of money. I think the Ambio cost at least $1,500, maybe up to $2,000. I'm not sure. The last time I checked the price on that was when I was in Australia. And then it kind of goes up from there with the Corsound Tetra mic, and then also the Soundfield mics as well. And then you can go right up to spending like as much as you would spend on a car for an Eigen mic, or even more if you wanted to buy one of these Visisonics sound cameras too. But you can also rent them as well. So there's ways to get a hold of some of these technologies. So there are, I couldn't tell you any of them off the top of my head, but there are some that will rent some of these microphones to you so that you can experiment or use them on set to capture. The other approach, of course, is then obviously, like as I mentioned before, kind of doing it in the box. So if you have sound libraries of like mono sound sources that have already been captured, there are some sites that also carry like ambisonics recordings that they take themselves in library form. So you can go and buy ambisonics recordings, and then you can have your sound libraries of mono sources, and then pick an ambisonics panner to actually go and do that mix in the box, and then export that out to a VR headset and have a listen to it. So there's more than one way to skin a cat in this field, and that's kind of what makes it a really exciting place to be in and to be experimenting in as a content creator. So step one is always just research. into what is applicable for your particular workflow on your product, and then kind of go from there.
Awesome. I think so. Just to reiterate, you're talking about having libraries out there that you can download ambisonic recordings from, but as well as so combining ambisonics with single source recordings. And I mean, how do those two fit together? Ambisonics would basically fill out the gaps in between the sources that you spatialize within a field, or I don't know if I'm understanding.
Yeah, I mean, if you had like, for example, I know that there's one that's like a recording of like a cityscape or maybe like a park with this children playing, that sort of thing. But you wanted to, your 360 film has a dinosaur that stomps in and eats the children. Then, like, obviously, good luck getting an Ambisonics mic that can record that, mostly because dinosaurs aren't alive anymore unless you want to throw a chicken in the scene, which might not be cool. So you would end up, perhaps if you want, you could go and get an Ambisonics mic and do that recording of just the park or the cityscape, whatever it is. You could also go hit one of these library sites, grab an Ambisonics recording of a park or a cityscape. And then you'd need to supplement that with the sound of like the footsteps that you've designed, the dinosaur roar that you've designed, all these little bits and pieces. And then you're using an Ambisonics pan or something like Ambix or Blue Ripple if you wanted to go up to third order, even the Facebook 360 spatial workstation if you had no budget and wanted to just kind of start experimenting with a cool, fun 360 film. Yeah, and then it's a matter of using those panners to say, like, okay, like, so this distance, that direction, that elevation, this amount of room sound, and just keep iterating on the mix and positioning in that way. So that's kind of the process.
So we just talked about capture. Let's talk a little bit about the other end of the equation, which is the person and the ears. And so we lightly touch this with HRTF. Sal, if you can reintroduce what HRTF means, and we should talk a little bit about like what the current state of it is, you know, everyone having different ears and how that factors into this.
Yeah, absolutely. So HRTF stands for head-related transfer function. The head-related transfer function is kind of like the term that we use to describe the filter or the effect that you having a head puts on sound sources that are coming at you towards your ears. So there's many different parts of your anatomy that actually impact on the sound source in a way that allows you to tell where that particular sound source is coming from. So your ear is part of it. The fact that you have a solid head is part of it. Your shoulders are part of it. What clothes you're wearing could be part of it as well. It's very, very complex. And this is something that that research has been iterating on and trying to work out like what the most important parts are and then how we apply that across to industry and tools for many, 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 many decades. Kashik, if you want to expand even further, you totally can, because I know that this was your jam.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Sally got it there. So basically it's about how from a source to the eardrum, you know, what happens to the sound. That's basically HRTF. Mm-hmm. You know, so from the source, it goes through the medium and then it gets scattered with your head, with your ears. There's interference, you know, constructive and destructive interference. So certain frequencies gets enhanced, certain frequencies gets canceled out. And then your ear canal has its own resonance and it reaches your eardrum. So often people measure HRTFs all the way at the eardrum, but then of course it's not very practical. Yeah. So there have been techniques. There's a lot of research and where to place the microphones to measure HRTFs. And it's been found that if you place at the entrance of the blocked ear canal, that kind of captures all the directional aspects in a HRTF. So that's like the most commonly used technique to measure HRTFs. You often place very tiny probe microphones at the entrance of your ear canal and then measure HRTFs. Now, it's a very extremely tedious process of measuring HRTFs. because you can imagine that, you know, it's not just one direction. You have to have a good enough resolution. Usually people measure like 5 degrees resolution, and it's for the, it's for all this 360, you know, the entire sphere, basically 3D sphere. So it's extremely, you know, tedious to measure HRTFs, and add to that, if you're measuring for a human, you have to stay very still. You cannot move, and it's like a whole day process. Since our ears are as unique as fingerprints, I need to have HRTFs for every person. So it's very impractical. So there are techniques now. One of the very famous techniques is from this Maryland professor, University of Maryland professor Ramani Duraiswamy, where they use this principle of acoustic reciprocity. So instead of actually to make these HRTF measurement process really fast, instead of placing microphones in your ear and having speakers all around, what they do is they place speakers in your ear and microphones all around. You know, so it's like basically a reciprocal principle, and it has certain disadvantages, but they've proved that such a technique can, you know, it's just so much more faster. And so most of the research in this field is trying to increase the way HRTFs are measured, like much faster process, and how to generalize HRTFs, how to measure individualized HRTFs.
So at this point, go ahead, Sally.
Sorry, I was just going to follow through and mention that the way that a lot of the technology works at the moment, particularly software spatializers, if you're plugging in a pair of headphones into whatever device that you're listening to for VR, listening off of, if it's going through the headphones, like the headphones that I'm wearing right now, there'll be a conversion to binaural that's happening regardless of what format the audio was in originally. So if there's a trend, like if there's that conversion to binaural that's happening, and there was no like personalization or a step where you could input a HRTF that you've had previously recorded, that means it's usually a generalized HRTF, like Kaushik mentioned before. And that's kind of industry standard at the moment. Most people, most developers are doing that, using that technology, because it's obviously like easier to process, because you don't have to try and do any individualization step and factor that into the processing that's happening for desktop-based VR or mobile-based VR. But then you also cut out that step where you have to try and figure out a way to get that data about people's ears off them to use in your processing. That's a really tricky thing. It's like, not everyone's going to want to, you know, rock up to a university somewhere and spend a day sitting very, very still with their hair tied back, in an uncomfortable chair just to get this particular, recording done for them. Even though it makes the results sound that much better, and the quality of localization and source, being able to tell where sounds are, that much better.
So yeah, a lot of research at this point of time is happening on how to process easier, right? How to capture your individualized HRTF. So now there are techniques, optical techniques, like taking 3D mesh images of your ears and then solving numerical equations with boundary element methods to actually get the HRTF. So that's one kind of technique. But the problem there is you need very, very high resolution 3D mesh image of your ear. And in fact, recently Genelac and this Finnish company called IDEA, they're saying they're going to release an app next year where you can just take like a image from your phone and it spits out HRTFs.
They were at the Audio Engineering Society conference in October this year. And I think you can get like a video recording of your ear done like in a site in New York, but when they have the app out, you'll have to like do one of these things where you like wave the phone around your head in a very particular way to get that particular model generated for your ear. But that's really exciting technology, and it's something that we've been anticipating as being like applicable over the industry for a couple of years now.
Have you either of you looked into the iPhone 10's sensors that
yeah
and do you yeah, think so- is that good enough to, you know, that you'd want to at least experiment
that's,
with?
That's a hard question to answer whether it's good enough, because unless you actually do it, you wouldn't know. But we really, I don't know exactly what kind of resolution that can that the iPhone XS do, but
40,000 points that it's using.
Okay.
Which is it?
Okay.
Not that high resolution, to be honest, but also not that low. It's way less than the Kinect, for example, had. But because you have it so close to the object itself, technically it should be maybe enough.
But that's what I mean. There is no reason to believe why this kind of technology would, right? Like, you, in future, you're just going to have higher and higher resolution. And techniques like, you know, getting HRTF from optical methods like this, they're just going to happen. It's happening already. We see that right now. And that maybe, you know, it could be some kind of a sensor fusion at the end of the day. Be partly acoustic, partly this, you know. So it's just making how to get this to consumers at the end of the day.
That's the big challenge.
What do you see exactly in the near future? Some current methods that are going to really improve the audio quality of individualized HRTFs. I mean, this is one example is to, you know, get a mesh of the ear. Mm-hmm. Another, do you think, you know, headphones are, you know, you guys worked on OSIC. I think that was something that they were really pushing on, is that they want to personalize sound to the individual's ears. Maybe not particularly to OSIC, but like, can you talk a little bit about how someone would go about to do that?
So, I mean, so headphones, when you talk about headphones, that's again a whole, it's a different world because, we often talk about HRTFs and individualizes, but what we ignore is when you place headphones in your ear, that again affects the sound. So no headphone is transparent in nature. It has its own transfer function. You have to equalize the headphones. And the challenging part there is every time you remove the headphone and place it back, due to repositioning, again, the responses at the eardrum is different. All the high frequencies gets changed. So it's a very, very challenging and tricky problem of headphone equalization. So there have been techniques both in the measurement world, you know, getting better and better measurement equipments like dummy heads, which has good fit to the headphones in order to, you know, improve repeatability of measurements and getting the headphone equalization filter right, you know, because at the end of the day, you might use a certain headphone equalization filter and compensate for the effects of headphone. But, you know, if you're placing the next time you wear the headphones, you're placing it in an altogether different way. And the very tiny changes on how you place the headphone in your ear makes a lot of difference on the high frequencies. So there have been improvements everywhere. You know, it's about, and of course, these equipments are extremely expensive too. So it's if you look at it, what makes it challenging is it's the whole pipeline, right? From the measurement stage, understanding the acoustics, you know, you need really good equipments. Not just that, you need good anechoic chambers, all those things which not everyone can afford. You know, only like really big companies can afford, and universities can afford that. And then, of course, then what kind of headphones you use. And as I was talking about HRTFs and everything, like every aspect of it is important, and it needs to be right. And that's what makes it very challenging. And that's why it's important to understand every aspect of it in order to debug where the problem is.
Even right down to like the sound itself that you're using or that you're working with, that can impact on your ability to localize sound as well. So whether you have a very low frequency sound or just a very loud sound in general, like an explosion, those particular sounds may be more or less localizable. They may be coloring the HRTFs that you're putting into the processing, as well as the headphones that you're using as well. It's all very, very complex, and it's really hard to separate which step is breaking down the perfect localization that we're trying to achieve, particularly in industry as well. and particularly in interactive environments, because you could have six players in a game all shooting their guns at the same time. Good luck localizing any of those.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, HRTFs, usually the critical aspect is like the high frequencies that contributes more to the individualization, because ears are small, the cavities are smaller, so it's all high frequencies that gets affected. But if you think about it, most of the music content won't even have those high frequencies. So, you know, so it makes it extremely challenging.
Is the point that you're trying to make that high frequency sounds are more noticeable, the direction that they come from are more noticeable to your ears than lower frequencies?
Yeah, you need broadband sounds basically to localize it extremely well. But then there is another aspect of it. There have been academic research where they have they've done subjective experiments with really narrow band sounds at low frequencies, but subjects have been able to localize it even then, you know, in real life. So there is another aspect of it where we still don't understand how humans really perceive direction, you know, what cues we use. And that makes it, you know, all the more challenging.
Let's talk a little bit about that, actually, the different cues that you use to actually localize sound. I think the ones that come to mind are interaural time differences, where the sound that hits one ear is faster than the sound that hits the other ear, and interaural level difference, right, which is the acoustic shadow that one ear gets that the other ear doesn't get. And the level difference is apparent that you can understand that the sound is coming from one direction rather than the next. I think those are the basic ones.
Those are the basic ones that helps you to localize, say, lateral sounds, something, you know, on your right side, on your left side, you know. But the challenging thing is, what happens if the sound source is exactly in the middle, in the median plane, you know, where your ITDs, the time differences and the level differences with both the ears are close to zero now, because the distances are same and there's no head shadowing and anything there. That's where your ear comes into picture. That's where your pinna or the external ear comes into picture. And what happens is, as the sound waves come towards your come towards you, it hits your head, of course, and then these tiny cavities in your external ear, and then goes to the eardrum. Now, because of this, you have a certain pattern of frequencies is created at the eardrum, and this is a pattern of frequency that, you know, that corresponds to the HRTF. It's extremely unique to you. You have learned that pattern right from your childhood, and you recognize it. So you recognize it as, like, if you notice this particular pattern in your eardrum, your brain understands that, oh, so now this is this direction. So it's a learning process. Those are like the spectral cues. Those are very, very important cues in localizing sound. And that's why if I replace your ear by my ear, you will get confused, because that's something new to you that you haven't learned from your childhood. And that's when you get confusions, like front to back confusions, you know, up down confusion, localization error, all sorts of things.
How long does it take the brain to rewire? So let's say someone has some injury with the ears, or you actually, for just the fun of it, take all the sound from outside, modulate it, and give it directly to the ear without having it. So can the brain remap it?
There are definitely techniques. One of the individualization technique is you can take some other HRTF, start training training your ear to learn that. That's one way. But then the moment you come out of that world, you have your own ear first, But you talking about like injury and everything. Yes, definitely. I think human brain is extremely smart that way. I don't know exactly how much longer it takes, but yes, you can train yourself.
But let's say we take someone who is an adult right now, and he uses VR very frequently. And as we discussed, the spatial audio model in virtual reality is not perfect yet. And He obviously didn't measure his ears, so he spends really a lot of time in VR, and his brain kind of learns to map the visual information to this kind of not very natural spatial audio information, and then he goes into the real world. Will he be confused or not? So will there be some mismatch between his VR learned audio perception and the real life perception?
Or is definitely. I think that's where all the challenges arise. You know, how can you make sure you know your real life audio cues are similar to your VR audio cues? And you know, like one of the things about, say, for example, I know you have it in your list on, you know, understanding near field and distance perception, but I think I would want to point out that thing right here, that for distance perception, the reverberant energy is extremely important. The direct to reverberant energy ratio is one of the very important cues to understand distance perception.
Can you explain what that means?
So basically, say if you have a sound source right in front of you, right, and you're at a distance, say 1 meter, and you have walls around, and there is a certain direct energy and a certain reverberant energy that reaches your eardrum. Now, as you go further and further, you know, what happens, your direct energy reduces and the reverberant energy starts becoming more and more constant, you know. So that's a cue. So as you go farther away, you know, direct energy is reducing while the reverberant energy is starting to remain constant. So that's a cue to your human brain. And that's one of the ways you determine what distance the source is. But then if you think about it, it's extremely dependent on the room or the environment you're in. And that's what makes it very challenging. There are experiments, you know, there's a lot of experiments in understanding distance perception in real life. And you notice that even in real life, in a very, very ideal scenario, the ability to perceive distance is very poor. What happens is humans often overestimate distances in the near field and underestimate distances in the far field. So, you know, there is like an acoustic horizon in the far field beyond which you can't really make out what the distance is. Of course, relative distance you can, like if the subject is if a source is moving towards you or farther from you, you can say something, because then now you have also have dynamic relative cues. But then if it's a static source, it's the direct to reverberant energy that makes a difference.
I think evolutionarily that makes sense, right? Like you need to know and predict and localize a sound that's coming within, let's say, what, like 20, 30 meters, right? Yeah. 20, 30 meters by you, rather than, you know, or if you hear sounds reverberating through the mountains, like a cry,
yeah,
you can, yeah, understand which direction that's coming from.
Yeah, evolutionary, and a lot of it is to do with familiarity of the sound. And you know, a speech signal, you know, it's not someone whispering, you know, that it's a different kind of sound. But if you look at the eardrum, if you just measure the SPL, that might be very similar to a sound source which is really, really far off. But you know that whispering is someone very close to your ear. So there's a lot of evolutionary things, I know, as you're talking about. But what makes it tricky is understanding all of them and you know, emulating it in a VR system.
So beneath just the ears itself, I would maybe assume that the human also perceives, for example, very low frequencies through the vibration of the body. And there is obviously also some acoustic effects where sound hits your forehead and resonates.
Yes.
How important is that, and would you need to simulate that too to recreate a perfect VR sound experience, or is it just enough to use headphones?
I mean, ideally, I think yes. So that's what I call it as a bone-conducted sound. So sound, there are two pathways, right? One is through the air, through the ear canal, and it reaches your eardrum, and the other through the bones. And that's why if you actually close both the ears and talk to yourself, you sound more louder. It's now what you're hearing too is the bone conducted sound, not the air conducted sound. And there's a lot of research in this particular field, but this is something which is much, much less understood than like the air conducted path. But yeah, there are all these missing puzzles in this area.
Mm-hmm. So to tie it all back together and to kind of start wrapping this up, I think augmented reality is something we actually haven't talked much about, but that's starting to become a bigger part of our world just moving forward. And when you compare on the visual end, you know, the analysis that's being done on ambient lighting and the lighting conditions of your room, and to light the objects, the virtual objects that are within your room, to match the lighting, to create a sense of realism. Where do you see, you know, audio coming in that regard? Can it be using, you know, both the camera to do some kind of analysis of like the geometry of your room, plus, you know, the many microphones that are on your phone to maybe like understand the materials, or maybe even the sounds that are within the room to simulate how, you know, a virtual sound coming from a corner of your room would sound rather than in the middle? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think it's a really interesting space. And I think that like the suggestions that you've made and maybe some of the things that we've touched on previously, it's all possible. It's just a matter of will the experiences that we will be creating call for that level of detail? Because like an app that you use on your phone to measure how long a wall is in your house might not need to do a full scan of the room through whatever methods to have like a acoustically accurate rendering of that space. However, I can see that, like, especially with my interests and my passions in audio, that if I was to buy a Magic Leap headset and dial up one of their pieces of content, I know Dr. Grodbots is one of them, where you have like the steampunk robots that are popping through walls and stuff, I would actually find it very compelling to be convinced to have some sort of like scanning step that I do to calibrate the device to the room that it's in to get a better acoustical rendering so that I don't die every time a robot pops out of a wall behind me. And I think that makes the content, the potential for the content a lot more exciting and a lot deeper as well, because then you're not doing something like we're seeing with some VR at the moment, where if you're asking people to sit facing one direction and only have like 180 degrees worth of content that you can really, you know, spit at them, because the sensors, if you turn around, it's not going to be able to see whatever sensors are, you know, hooked up to the computer, and people only end up with a very limited field of vision of content that they can actually interact with. I think that if I'm going to be putting a device on my head that allows me to see into this augmented space that I can interact with and move through, that the call to action for audio to really step up and be part of that enhanced simulation and that enhanced experience is well above and beyond something like anything that we could experience with VR right now. And perhaps they will intersect at some point as well, where we can say like, hey, all of this processing that we're doing, this capture that we're doing of space, the calibration to the space, like we can put this on a head worn device now. So like, let's just cram that into our, you know, mobile style VR headsets as well. So for me, like as someone who understands all the tech behind it as well, the tech and the research behind it, but then also is really excited about the content that we can see in the future, now's the time to start dreaming about, you know, what the perfect acoustic rendering that we want to achieve in these experiences are, and what kind of impact that can have on our creative practice as well. I think that's one of the most exciting things that we can possibly start communicating about, talking to each other about, and then also like showing an interest in some of the research and some of the fringe technologies that are out there at the moment. Like, for example, like even NVIDIA has technologies that you can gain access to kind of to actually do like physically based rendering with their engines on their GPUs. So it's something that we can show more interest in as content creators, and perhaps, you know, encourage them to give us more access and then continue developing that in the future.
And Kaushik, you have any closing thoughts?
Definitely. I mean, as we discussed, it's such an exciting field right now. And there've been there's so many parts of it, and there is immense interest in each aspect of it, and there's immense interest in research, R&D happening. It's about understanding which of them actually matters, which do not matter in terms of perception, a lot of subjective evaluation has to happen in understanding the effect of each of these aspects. And I think we're just blessed to be in this era.
You guys have a unique set of skills and understand something that many people don't. For others, like the developers and whatnot that are listening, for them to find you and to ask you questions about what matters and what doesn't, how can people reach you? Sally, do you have a Twitter account or an email that you'd like to put out there?
Yeah, Twitter's the best way for me. I pretty much live on Twitter, so that's a thing. I am at Sounds by Sal, so SoundsbySal. And full disclosure, I also rant about cats and feminism on that account, as well as audio stuff. So you can DM me and get more information about any of the above, including like how cats perceive audio as well.
That's the next episode.
Underrated.
You can reach me on Twitter at KaumC, KaumC, or even on LinkedIn if you just search Kaushik Sundar. Yeah, you can find me, and you can reach out to me on any kind of audio perception related questions, 3D audio in general. I'll try my best to answer them.
Awesome, guys. Thank you again for joining us on this podcast. Thank you, listeners, for listening. If you like the podcast, please consider leaving a review on iTunes and follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with updates about what we're up to. I know we haven't posted, actually, by the time you're listening to this, it's probably December. Well, it is December now, but it's probably later in the month of December. And I hope everyone is enjoying their winter break. Thank you, Sally and Kaushik, again for joining us. This has been a fascinating episode talking about audio. And you guys all have a great rest of the 2017.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure being here.
Thank you again.
Yeah, thanks both of you.
Bye.
Goodbye.